Welcome to the Morning Mix for Friday, March 28th. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we learn how the corporate entertainment complex is outsourcing creativity and jobs away from Hollywood and California. We speak to an organizer who's trying to prevent that from happening. Then we turn our attention to education. Author and Professor Peter Linebaugh explains what the commons means in education. Then we'll turn our attention to a parent and student from Marin County who are asking why some of their favorite math teachers are being let go. Is there a connection to the Gates Foundation? We'll also have a new report from Project Censored's Validated Independent News. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The organization Public Citizen says the NAFTA trade deal caused a net loss of a million U.S. jobs in the 20 years since its enactment. Many are familiar with manufacturing jobs moving offshore. But we'll speak today with a guest who's trying to keep media work and entertainment work from leaving. She's Sharon Jimenez with the Bringing Hollywood Home Foundation, and here's Peter to introduce her.
Sharon Jimenez is the founder of Bring Hollywood Home and the president of Icon Imaging, PR. She's a veteran campaign leader, serving as a senior advisor to Dennis Kucinich's presidential campaign. She also worked very hard back in 1999 to secure a new city charter in L.A. that created neighborhood councils in the largest city in the state. She's worked in Northern California leading school reform measures and keeping issues in front of the media. Sharon, are you with us?
Yes, good morning. I'm here.
Sharon, tell us about the Bring Hollywood Home campaign and how that's going to increase jobs and try to get more films made in California.
Well, Peter and Mickey, we have a foundation, Bring Hollywood Home. It's a 501c4. We're the first lobby in the state of California led by independents, not led by the corporate studios and the corporate media. That makes us unique. It's been a long struggle for the past 4 years fighting censorship and inside politics in Sacramento to get to the point where we have our 501c4. I always say that it's one thing to vote, it's another thing to lobby. And as we all know, with big money controlling our lawmakers, that if we don't lobby and independents don't have a voice in Sacramento, we don't really have a voice because the lobbyists have such a stronghold on our lawmakers. And so it's been very difficult for the average person in small and medium-sized businesses to fight, especially during this very bad recession that we've had. And in Hollywood, the recession didn't just start in 2008. It started about 2.5 decades ago as we began to lose one job after the other in California as film producers left California and went to cities and states in countries where there were tax credit incentives, and the whole mechanism for funding films became this international global grab for what I call the fantastic fight for finite film resources. That's what we're in. And right now, we have an assembly bill, number 1780, that we have sponsored with assembly member Tim Donnelly, who is a Republican, surprisingly enough, out of San Bernardino County, which is a neighboring county adjacent to Los Angeles County. And what's interesting is that in order to win back Hollywood, we really do have to reach across party lines. We have to involve the rural counties, the red counties, and the blue counties, if we're going to win back Hollywood, because California has 4 times the economy of Texas and New York, which are our other big rivals for the largest economies in America. We have the resources now as we come out of this recession with a surplus this year to really start dealing with the job losses that have been just mind-boggling in Hollywood and the film and television industry. And the good news for those people who live in counties like Sonoma and the outlying counties is that AB 1780 includes a 5% tax credit incentive on top of a 30% tax credit incentive if filmmakers shoot in outlying areas. In other words, outside of the major cities, which helps the other counties in California that have really suffered even more than the major cities in the recession since 2008. So AB 1780 gives a great incentive to film in counties like Sonoma. We've also lowered our threshold, the threshold in California for qualifying for tax credits, to $500,000 instead of $1 million production. And you can bundle projects. So in other words, you don't have to have just a $500,000 film. You could have smaller films if they were bundled together to be $500,000 to go in and qualify for a tax credit incentive. And we've included now music videos and video game film production and feature film production and movie production in AB 1780. There is a corporate bill, number 1839, that already has 70 signatures on it from our lawmakers in Sacramento. And it is also going to help bring Hollywood home. However, the problem with 1830 is that it still leaves the California Film Commission, which is very industry heavy politically, in charge of all the money and the incentives and who gets it and what it goes for. Our bill is much more general. It doesn't have a cap. It has more generous tax credit incentives. And most of all, it's written by independents for independents. And the other 1839 is written by, you know, the corporate media and the corporate studios for the corporate media and the corporate studios. But, you know, it's better than nothing. We say we're really happy that they're finally getting into the game here and fighting for California. But what I say is that I'm not campaigning against their assembly bill, the bill supported by the California Film Commission. It's time they had a bill. But if you go to Vegas, you don't put all your money on one number, and particularly if that machine is taking your life savings. So you look for a new number, and the new number is Assembly Bill 1780. And on April the 30th, down in Southern California in Hollywood, we're having a benefit. And we hope that a lot of the folks that have been losing their jobs and who want to fight back, the independent producers for a more independent Hollywood media, will come and join us on April 30th. You can find out more about that on our website at bringhollywoodhome.org. That's bringhollywoodhome.org. So that's what we're doing here at Bring Hollywood Home. We've long been in the fight. Since my husband and I left the San Francisco Bay Area in 1991, fighting against censorship of news. My husband was a top anchor at Caroline TV, and both of us took on the fight against losing independent ownership of television and radio that led to the rise of the reign of junk food news, as all of you at Project Censor are so brilliantly bringing into the forefront now. And Bob and I are so heartened to know that 2.5 decades after we left San Francisco that the fight goes on, and that you all started it even before we left the Bay Area. The fight goes on to end censorship of news.
Sharon Jimenez from Bring Hollywood Home Foundation, could you talk to us a little more? It sounds like the bill that you're talking about, 1780, it's aimed at helping independent film, TV, music, musicians, artists. Talk a little bit about the labor part of this, the labor issue, and who is this really designed to help out, the 1780 bill?
The 1780 bill is really designed to help everybody. I mean, it's not exclusionary, which is really the wonderful part of the bill. It doesn't say that tax credit incentives can't go to the corporate media or the studios. And we know they'll have the best lawyers and the biggest fight out there to get the lion's share of the money. But what we do have is we have an emphasis on independent. And we don't want the tax credit incentives to all be overseen by the same corporate interests in California. We think that we need an independent commission. Listen to this. Listen to these figures in Business Insider. Movies not filming in California is costing the state $9.6 billion and 50,000 jobs. Okay, so if it's been costing the state all these jobs and all this money, why has nothing aggressively been done in Sacramento to react to this job outsourcing, to react to the competition from other states and other countries? Well, we know, those of us who are behind AB 1780, that the reason there has been a huge hue and cry is because there's so much profit in outsourcing middle-class jobs. We saw our manufacturing jobs go to other countries. Detroit still hasn't come back. We saw what happened to Michigan and Ohio and all the states that used to have the manufacturing in this country. Now, California, we're losing the creative economy. We're losing the entertainment industry. And why is that important? Because just like news, our performance, our media, our TV, our radio, our television and film, they export our values. They export what we care about. So what other culture in the history of the world has allowed their stories to be told by other countries and allow their stories to be told, you know, outside of their frame of reference and their cultural values?
Or, Sharon Jimenez, the notion that these big studios and corporations are basically co-opting the narratives and getting more independent voices and encouraging, giving an outlet to creative people of all stripes, not just among the 1%. That's a really part of that narrative.
That's a big part of the narrative. It's a big part of the narrative. We have to fight back against this, not only junk food news, but junk food entertainment. I mean, we've seen a decline in the quality of movies, in the quality of films. We've seen an awful lot of money spent on utter nonsense. When you take all this huge budget for a giant film, imagine if thousands of filmmakers across California had access to that kind of money to tell their stories. That's what AB 1780 is about. If you leave the money in the hands of the same people, how are you ever going to change the business model to make it truly aggressive, truly competitive, and truly democratic? You really can't. So what the big media has done is they've censored the rise of Bring Hollywood Home. We've had a really hard time getting our story out. We've had a couple of attack pieces done about us in the LA Times. The Hollywood Reporter wrote kind of a attack, kind of nice, you know, in-between story about us in 2012 when we threw our first concert here in Southern California to bring attention to Runaway Production. But again, the Hollywood Reporter, Variety, all the trades, Business Insider, The Wrap, they're all attached to the major studios. And the word independent is really an illusion because all of the independent filmmakers depend still on a business model that leaves the big studios and the corporate media in charge of whose film gets into a movie theater. You know, when these new movie theaters came up all across the state with so-called independent films, all of us were super excited. Oh, my goodness, there are all these movie theaters now for independent films. But, you know, quickly that was co-opted. And the only independent films that make it into those movie theaters are the ones that a piece of the profits go to the big corporations. And while we know that we're fighting Godzilla, I mean, we are really fighting the Loch Ness Monster here, and I call it the Monster Mash. It's a graveyard smash, meaning California becomes the graveyard of Hollywood if we don't fight the Monster Mash. In other words, the corporate control of media and the outsourcing of these jobs from California that profits the few at the expense of the many.
So, Sharon, this whole effort, Bring Hollywood Home, what it sounds like is you want to get a tax credit approved so that independent companies can produce competitively worldwide, and that would help bring back some of these thousands of jobs that have been lost by exporting filmmaking.
Absolutely. Listen, there are groups out there, including the Film and Television Action Committee, that said, hey, we have to stop this whole tax credit incentive thing. It's a race to the bottom. So for about 10 years, they spun their wheels trying to raise enough money to go and attack the U.S. trade laws and interstate commerce laws and try to enforce the laws that would say that we can't exclude people from working in the United States from one state to the next. And that the free trade agreements, especially when all the filming started going to Canada, actually should have protected the iconic Hollywood industry in California from the grabbing of our jobs. But it didn't. And what happened was they all failed. They could never raise enough money to go in and lobby Congress and to file lawsuits to try to enforce these laws. I mean, we don't even enforce our antitrust laws in America anymore. And that's why, like, unlike 1930 when Roosevelt was president and we came out of the Great Depression, we don't have the same resolve in the halls of Congress or in the halls of Sacramento to fight the antitrust war, to fight this globalization that seems like it's just strangling small businesses. Not only film, but, you know, you see these big box stores that have strangled all this mom-and-pop stores, even in all the rural counties of California where you drive in from one place to the next and every place really looks the same because we all have the same stores. Why is that? Why don't we have more variety? Are we all the accidental tourists now? Harking back to that film that talked about how we love familiarity and our fear of the unknown. Well, now our fear of the unknown has led to this kind of sterile economic environment in the United States and in California. We want to change that, and we know that through media we can change that. We can end the reign of junk food entertainment and end the reign of junk food news, but only if we get control of some of the dollars. So we don't want all the tax credits to go to the big studios and the big corporations to be overseen by the California Film Commission, which to its own admittance has ruled over California as we've lost $9.6 billion, a new study by the Southern California Association of Governments, while we've lost $9.6 billion in our economy and 50,000 jobs. Why should we give all the control over to the losing team?
We're speaking with Sharon Jimenez of Bring Hollywood Home Foundation. What's the website again, Sharon?
It's bringhollywoodhome.org. You can send us your email. You can sign up. And if you happen to be in the Southern California area, we'd love to have you come to our night of magic to benefit Bring Hollywood Home. We say that it's going to take the courage and tenacity of Houdini to win back Hollywood.
Thanks, Sharon Jimenez, for the work you're doing, and thanks for joining us today to tell us about this issue.
And thank you for the great work you're doing with Project Censored.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In today's Project Censored Validated Independent News Report, Alexandria McDowell takes a look at the Pentagon's inauditable budget.
For Project Censored, I'm Alexandria McDowell. Today's Validated Independent News Story. Congress has recently decided to expand the Pentagon's 2014 budget by $32 billion. When its current budget is combined with supplemental war funding, the Pentagon currently receives over $600 billion annually. The Pentagon's significant budget affects every person in this country. We have to ask ourselves, where does all that money go? Dave Gilson for Mother Jones writes that the Pentagon's books are, quote, a complete mess. The Government Accountability Office claims that, quote, serious financial management problems make the Pentagon's financial statements, quote, inauditable, end quote. Despite a 1997 requirement that federal agencies submit to annual audits, the Pentagon, Gilson reports, claims it will not, quote, achieve audit readiness until 2017. Lack of budgetary accountability has led to risky investments by the Pentagon, including, for example, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. As Gilson summarizes, that F-35 program is, quote, years behind schedule, hugely over budget, and plagued with problems. The Mother Jones report also analyzes how congressional interests and coalitions contributed to the protection of the Pentagon budget, even at a time when Congress was imposing spending reductions to food stamps and other mandatory social programs. Though fiscal conservatives in Congress favored defense cuts, they aligned with conservative hawks to impose social cuts rather than reduce the Pentagon's budget. Similarly, those conservative hawks found allies among liberal hawks who were not supportive of domestic cuts but also wanted more funding for military. As Gilson observes, military spending was, quote, the glue holding the budget deal together, end quote. The Pentagon is supposed to protect and serve its citizens. However, with flagrant disregard for the misuse of hard-earned taxpayer dollars begs the question of how the largest national defense program in the world is able to protect its country but not able to balance its books. This has been Alexandria McDowell for Project Censored. This underreported news story was researched by Janae Acevedo at Sonoma State University and evaluated by Professor Peter Phillips as part of Project Censored's Validated Independent News Program. For more validated independent news stories, go to projectcensored.org and follow the link for validated news.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're going to devote the rest of today's program to the fight against privatization efforts in education. Later on, we'll hear from a student and parent in Northern California High School District in Marin County who want to know why some of their favorite math teachers are being fired. But we begin with a conversation with author Professor Peter Linebaugh, who's written extensively about privatization and attacks on the public commons across history. His most recent book is Stop Thief. Today he'll speak to us about privatization efforts in U.S. schools. Here's Peter Phillips to introduce him.
Peter Linebaugh is a professor of history at the University of Toledo. He's author of The London Hanged, Crime and Civil Society in the 18th Century, and author of a new book called Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance. We've asked him to comment today on public education and the continuing privatization of education, kind of a loss of the commons. I mean, historically, if we go back, public education really didn't even exist. It was all done in the community, in families, sometimes in partnership with other families. And we saw the imposition of required public education at the time of industrialization. So can you speak a little bit about that as education in the commons?
Sure. Let's go back to Ned Ludd. Ned Ludd was a mythic figure who was held up by the weavers and artisans, the hand workers, during the Industrial Revolution against the destruction of their work, against the destruction of their communities. The community always rests on the future. It rests on raising the children to produce the next generation, a great and important labor, second to none. And the nurturance and socialization of children was conducted by apprenticeship. It was conducted by mothers. It was connected by a folk culture where children worked alongside in the field, in the common fields, in the shops, and were taught sometimes by specialists in hedges, in the case of Ireland, in hedge schools, and in the case of England, very much apprenticeship. But the steam engine, the factory, destroyed this possibility. And with that destruction begins the nightmare of the enclosed school where the child is taught to be still, to sit down, not to look out. At an age when our bodies are such that they are brimming with excitement for movement, for learning of our hands, of our shoulders, of our legs, of our life. Great energy is enclosed and must submit to the chair.
Submitting to the chair, also submitting to a hierarchical authority. more of a linear approach to dealing with issues of education, and particularly in the privatization of education and education for profit. That's also another way of taking really, again, enclosing the commons of human knowledge and trying to take it away from people as a right.
Yeah, well, there was a particular type of knowledge, which was literate knowledge, and literacy historically had belonged to the ruling class. The ruling class had hired its priests, you know, for hundreds of years to do the writing for them, for it. But it's only in the last 200 years that writing began to be used as the sole means of expression of knowledge for children. And I think all of us know what a terror that is, and many of us, as children anyway, the first tyrant we would meet would be the English teacher, who could tell us what to say and how to spell it. And if we didn't speak correctly or spell it accurately, we were submitted to punishment, or even more lasting damage, we were called dumb. And that most ideological of all words in the pedagogical vocabulary, namely smart, and its opposite, dumb, became the method of hierarchy, as you put it. People learn at different rates, and they learn from different people.
And they learn in different ways. And the model that we see in the so-called education reform movement of the present, very heavy on a preset, preordained notion of what is to be learned, or I would say memorized.
And how to do it. They're using now increasing machines to do the teaching. It's the mechanization of knowledge by the digit machine, which only means the fingers. But before, our actual fingers are far more creative than the electronic pulses of the computers. So I think the replacement of teachers by machines, the standardization and the uniform character of knowledge and learning is being enforced by the machine. And it's a time for Captain Ludd to reappear.
New technologies, new tech, high tech in public schools and private schools, charter schools, is endorsed and funded by the world's richest person, Bill Gates. Mm. And millions of dollars have gone into this sort of privatization and methodologies of using machines to teach children that kind of eliminates probably the joy of education, in that there's a creativity that goes on among young people because they want to build new ideas, they want to understand, they want to create the ideas of their own in many ways. And teachers know that by stimulating that and by helping that, it really manifests a full person, a self-actualized person.
Yes, people should read again Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And I recommend to your listeners Ivan Ilyich's De-schooling Society. These will open up the mind to the thought that you expressed. It will develop it. I mean, at the University of Toledo, the increasing ranks of the administrators have been bewitched, so to speak, by Salman Khan and the mountebanks of rapid mechanical transmission of knowledge. I oppose it deeply.
We see this happening at all levels of education, including, you just mentioned, so-called higher education, colleges and university system. I mean, again, this is pretty much the new standard, as we put it. And as Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, you were speaking of, you know, digits and digital, the digital age and digital technology. This is really being imposed from the top down. And it's, again, I would argue, continuing an enclosure of what it means to be educated. And it's happening in an arena that we would historically refer to as the commons, but it's again being taken away, it's being closed off, it's being refashioned.
To create mind-forged manacles, to colonize the interior between our ears.
Those are powerful words.
Thank you.
So that's a really incredible statement. How do we address this? How do we build a commons to challenge this top-down manipulation of public education?
I'm not sure, but I think we can take our lead from the kids.
The kids are commoning, as you would say.
Yes, they must have not just a seat at the table, but they must help us. They can lead us if we pay attention to them.
That's very important. We need to be listening.
Otherwise, they'll pick up a rifle. because this is what the society offers. And they will shoot one another in their suicidal desperation, because the life present to them is soulless, and it's an inferno.
Unfortunately, we've been seeing more and more of that in the United States over the last couple decades.
Quite so.
These are all connected issues. We're speaking with historian Peter Linebaugh, author most recently of Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance, out now from PM Press. Peter Linebaugh, thank you so much for joining us today to talk a little bit more about education.
You're welcome.
This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. We're going to continue our theme of education. We're going to talk more specifically, however, about privatization of education and some issues going on in the Tamalpais School District in Marin County, Northern California. Recently, there has been some rather controversial measures afoot, and it involves the letting go of several popular math teachers that were untenured. But it's broader than that. This is about specifically a company called NewTek. It's also in part about the Gates Foundation and funding and privatization of education. And we're joined by two people that are going to tell us about the specifics of what's happening in the Tamalpais High School. We're joined by Urban Carmel, who's a parent in the district, and we're also joined by a student named Emma. So, Urban and Emma, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, this is Peter Phillips. I'm looking at an article from the Marin Independent from 3/12/14. Tamalpais Union School Board upholds dismissal of popular math teachers. And it says nearly 100 people turned out in support of three highly regarded math teachers who have been terminated at the end of this year, so are being dismissed. So that's part of why you're talking today. So tell us what's been happening there.
Let me just say a little bit about myself first, if you don't mind. We've been living in Mill Valley for 14 years. We moved here. My son was 2 years old. My daughter was 4 years old. Both of them obviously weren't in the school system yet. And they've done all of their schooling through the Mill Valley public school system. They started at Old Mill. They went to the middle school. My daughter graduated from Tam High School last year. And I want to just start by saying it's an excellent school system. I mean, both of them have received an outstanding education. I want to thank the teachers who have done a terrific job. My daughter is now a freshman at Berkeley, and I think it's in large part due to the outstanding job that the teachers do in this district and in this town. My wife and I have also been very enthusiastic supporters of the educational system in Mill Valley. We are nobody's idea of radical people. We have been, you know, generous donors to Kiddo and the TAM Foundation. My wife sits on the TAM Foundation Grant Committee. I've been on the site council for 6 years at two different schools. I was the president at one school, and I was a board member at both of them. And I was asked by both principals that I worked with during those 6 years to stay on for a third year. So I think we've been very constructive at working with the school system, very supportive of the school system, and we're very enthusiastic about the school system that we have in Mill Valley. So there are two issues that have come up recently, and I would say, speaking from a parent perspective, both of these things took us by surprise. The one that's gotten the most attention in the community are the three teachers that were let go from Tam High. And what's interesting, first of all, to note is that there are 38 teachers who were on probation, you know, in that probationary period, right, where they're not tenured. Four of them were not rehired, and three of those are in the TAM math department. So right off the bat, you'd say, well, that's interesting. Why are all of these teachers in the TAM math department suddenly being let go? I mean, way out of proportion to the rest of the district. Two of these teachers were very, very seasoned. One was a new teacher. Two were very seasoned. You know, I'm obviously not privy to their performance records, but what I've understood is that their performance was outstanding, that they had gotten very favorable reviews from their superiors, One of them had been offered a job as an assistant principal in a different district and went to the administration, told them about this, and was encouraged to stay. So when they were subsequently let go a couple of weeks ago, this was a big surprise. It was a big surprise to parents and the students because I can say that my son was in one of their classes last year, and we certainly were very happy. But it was also a surprise to the teachers themselves, which is a little bit of a shock. And it was a surprise to the head of the math department. So apparently nobody was prepared for these teachers to not be rehired. And I think that raises a question. You know, we all know that people can get fired in the world, right? Bankers can get fired, lawyers can get fired, scientists can get fired, right? So, and we all know that the administration has obviously got the prerogative not to rehire people. There's no argument about that. But if your level of understanding about this issue stops there and says, well, that's their prerogative, you're really missing a big point, which is that you need to treat teachers professionally if you want to have an excellent school system. And there is a review process, and the review process basically dictates that teachers that are not performing are informed that they're not performing, and they're given an opportunity to improve their performance. I think this is basic common sense. I've spent my career working with Fortune 10 companies all the way down to small startups. And you can talk about innovation, you can talk about being in the right market, but the thing which makes the most difference to the success of companies is, of course, their ability to attract and retain quality employees. And, of course, the school system is no different than any of that. And I think this speaks to an issue which has come up recently, which is how do we treat the teachers in our school system? Do we not give them a chance to improve their performance? And do we not, in fact, encourage teachers that are doing well to stay in our school system? And what does that say about our ability to attract new teachers to replace these teachers in the future? If I were a teacher in a different school district and I was thinking about coming to TAM, I would now have some reservations because I don't know how I'm going to be treated in the school system. And that is a concern for me as a parent because I think education is a bedrock in the Mill Valley community, and it's certainly something I want to see strengthened over time. So that is the issue with the teachers. And like I said, most of these teachers, three of the four teachers that were not renewed, were in the TAM math department. And that raises a red flag. Why was that? Well, this then dovetails into the second issue, which is New Tech Network, NTN.
Urban, let's pause right there for one moment before we get into New Tech. Pause and bring Emma into the conversation because you were talking about these teachers, and we have Emma with us who's a student at TAM High, and I wanted to have her voice in here and hear some of her perspective about that issue, and then we'll come back to you, Urban, about New Tech Network. Emma?
So I have Mr. Fairbanks this year, and he's been an amazing teacher, and I've heard, like, really high stories and things about Ms. Fedoroff and Mr. Vidal. He was, like, a great person. And when I found out, everyone was really upset about it. Our school, it started out as a rumor at first, and everyone was just becoming outraged, and everyone was like, why are they firing them? Why are they letting them go? Why are they not being reelected to come back next year? And everyone was really shocked and saddened by all this, and it was really out of the blue, and it was just a huge tragic thing. And later that weekend, me and my friends, we had started a petition for Mr. Fairbanks, and another one of my friends started a petition for Ms. Fedoroff, and we were really committed to trying to get them to stay at TAM because we really loved them, and we know the whole student body at our school loves these teachers, and we'd really love for them to stay and have other future students at our school get to have them and have this amazing experience with them like I have this year with Mr. Fairbanks and other kids have with Ms. Fedoroff. And so when we got 370 signatures so far for Mr. Fairbanks and for Ms. Fedoroff, there's 450 signatures on the petitions for both of them. And there's definitely an overwhelming amount of support for them to try to keep their jobs. But we went to the board meeting, and me and the other people who started the petition for Fedoroff, we presented it to the school board because we were really hoping and crossing our fingers that they would get to be reelected and actually get to stay at TAM. And we voiced our opinions and our experiences and of how great of a teachers they actually were. And teachers spoke to, even Mr. Wetzel, the head of the math department, he spoke, and he got a little teary up there, and that just made, like, everyone was really devastated by this loss because they knew that these teachers were just, like, amazing and so well-loved. And everyone was just completely devastated by it. And then at the end of the meeting, when we were told that they were going to be upholding their same decision, that they were going to be let go and not reelected, everyone was just really upset, I remember. Everyone just got up and walked out. Pretty outraged by that.
And Emma, it's also, there's seeming lack of transparency around the decision-making process.
Yeah, yeah. It seemed like they didn't really even listen to us when we were in the boardroom. They were just already so set in their decision already with their, like, their ulterior motive with, like, New Tech and other stuff.
Well, let's get back to the New Tech Network and Urban Carmel. Let's talk a little bit about this New Tech Network, because the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is really a big mover and shaker in the so-called education reform movement, which some critics have referred to as a privatization of education movement. So it's actually something that's fairly controversial. The Gates Foundation sunk $10 million into the New Tech Foundation. The assistant superintendent, Michael McDowell, has worked for New Tech Foundation in several different capacities. The New TAM High School principal, Julie Sinyard, was on the board of Napa Learns, which partnered with New Tech and Knowledge Works. And Knowledge Works is the parent organization of New Tech Network that works with Gates and the Gates Foundation and the Walton family. And Knowledge Works also partners with the Brookings Institute, which is a neocon think tank. And they fired Diane Ravitch not long ago after her Death and Life of American Education System came out. I mean, this is a complicated network of things here that's, you know, possibly looming large over what's happening at TAM High.
Right. Yes, you're right. So the Gates Foundation, works outside of education as well, right? So they also work in healthcare, and I actually do a lot of work in healthcare. So, you know, and they're very focused on working with disadvantaged people, right? People who have got disease, which they can't deal with on their own. So they've been very active in coming up with, for example, vaccines. And so my, you know, take is that they are trying to help, you know, trying to be helpful at least in helping disadvantaged children also learn. And so I think that's their angle into New Tech Network. So New Tech Network started in Napa, and the idea was that, you know, schools there were not performing well. Let's try to come up with a way of helping kids that are not doing so well in school to do better, right? And their approach was to come up with this way of teaching them where they work in groups, right, so that the students are working together. They're using a lot of laptops and iPads, and the teachers are there basically to facilitate them. And the whole concept was that it would be like the workplace, right, where people work together, they try to support each other, right, they've got a boss who kind of facilitates them, and that's basically the concept. And so that was started in Napa, and it's been rolled out a little bit outside of Napa. But the main point to remember is that it really was about helping these kids that weren't doing particularly well in school. That's really the key to this whole thing. So what is New Tech Network? So they're primarily just in two states. They're in California and they're in Indiana. They're not in more than half of the country. And in many of the states that they are in, they're really just in one or two schools in that entire state. In the state of California, they're only in 11 high schools, okay? There are over 1,000 high schools in California, and out of that entire population, they're in 11. So they're pretty small, right? It's pretty limited. The second thing which is important about them is that they're only really working with schools that are not performing very well, or they're working with charter schools. And from the Tamil Pious perspective, what's interesting here is that it would be essentially the first school that would be one of the top 50 schools in the state of California to employ New Tech Network on a wide scale in a top-performing school. And what's, I think, a little bit of a concern to TAM parents is that that is a model which has not been tested whatsoever, right? So if I look at, for example, the SAT scores for TAM High, they're over 230 points higher than they are for the flagship new technology school in Napa Valley. If I look at the proficiency of students in math, something like over 40% of the kids in New Tech are graded as not proficient in district math tests. And at TAM, of course, you know, only 10% or 15% are graded as not proficient. So you're basically taking a system which has been used, and maybe it's been successful, we don't know, because it's not been peer-reviewed, in low-performing schools, and you're trying to insert that into a school which is a high-performing school.
Who's trying to insert that? Are you saying that the administration, the superintendent, assistant superintendent, are trying to push New Tech into the high school, and so, the math department resisted, and that's why these layoffs happened?
Well, it's hard to understand why three teachers from TAM math department were let go. I mean, TAM was doing very well, right? You know, if you look at TAM and Redwood, these are supposedly, you know, two very comparable high schools. None of the math teachers from the Redwood High School were let go, right? TAM actually scores higher on the SAT math section than Redwood does. So it's hard to understand, for us at least, what the problem was here. Yeah, can we make improvements in the math department? Absolutely. Can we make improvements at TAM overall? Absolutely. I mean, TAM always has, you know, opportunities to get better.
And we only have about a minute in this segment left. So what are you hoping that comes out of this?
What we're hoping for is more transparency. It's a little bit like the teachers. That's why these issues are related. What is the goal of the administration with respect to New Tech Network? Are they going to put a school within a school at TAM, which would be probably fine, or are they going to try to do a larger scale rollout of New Tech Network in the school system where a lot of the kids are in a program, and in fact, over time, the whole school becomes like New Tech Network? It's very unclear what their thoughts are here. We've understood that 19 teachers at TAM are now being taught to teach in the New Tech methodology, that next year, freshman and sophomore classes, half of those students are going to be taught in the New Tech Network system. Okay, that's a lot. And what I would suggest is that we have an open discussion about what the pros and cons are of moving to this system. What is the cost of using this system? How is the system performed in schools that are high performing? If there's a solid reason for employing this methodology to teach students at TAM, let's have that discussion. You know what? And if it stands up to public scrutiny, all for the better, right? We're all for improving our schools. But let's see the data. Let's see the plan. And let's have some transparency. And most importantly, let's have an open dialogue about New Tech and at TAM.
And let's keep the public in public education. Urban Carmel, thanks for joining us today. Emma, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about the experiences you've had there.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That concludes our Project Censored program for today. The Project Censored show originates at KPFA Studios in Berkeley, California for Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, and Rod Akil, the controls. We'll see you next time.